From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
The defense lawyers, they would pick up the file the day of trial, and I would have worked 3 or 4 weeks getting ready for this.
Fred Levin talks about the secret to his success and about ethical challenges.
I think that the defense bar has a lot more problems with ethics than the plaintiff's bar.
And about his regrets during an extraordinary career of nearly 60 years.
The regrets concern family. I was not a good husband and I was not a good father.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I'm Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. You may know Fred Levin as the father of the Florida tobacco lawsuits. He rewrote the Florida Medicaid Third-Party Recovery Act in 1993 to allow the state of Florida to sue the tobacco industry. The state of Florida eventually settled for $13 billion from the tobacco companies and forever changed the face of tobacco litigation in the United States. But if not for a stubborn client who refused to settle an insurance case nearly 60 years ago, Fred may not have become a trial lawyer. Among his many honors is the Perry Nichols Award, the Florida Justice Association's most prestigious. It's given to an attorney whose perseverance, commitment, and unmatched dedication to the civil justice system is at the forefront of his or her life. Fred Levin, now age 80 and still practicing law, sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in late August 2017 to discuss the keys to his success, his few regrets, the ethics problems he sees in the trial bar, and his advice to those practicing trial law today or those thinking about it.
Fred, you're known for being one of the attorneys who won the major big tobacco settlement case back in the 1990s, $13 billion, and rewrote the law that helped enable that to happen. That must have been a thrill.
Well, it happened by accident. Originally, someone had come to me a few weeks before this all came about and asking me if I would like to participate in a lawsuit being brought, at that point, by the state of Mississippi against Big Tobacco, and wondered if I would be willing to do it for the state of Florida. And I turned it down. I said there were just too many problems with a case against Big Tobacco. Number one, they had never paid a cent in any of the cases. And when the state would sue for the damages, they would be subject to the defenses that would have been available to the tobacco company, such as if the state of Florida were to sue for the damages done to John Doe, that the state had to supplement with medical bills and other things, that if John Doe was himself negligent, then the state would have to take that defense to overcome comparative negligence. Then most people who smoke, they don't smoke the same cigarette throughout their lifetime. And so you've got that problem of changing brands, which means the defendants may change. Then you got the third, or one of the problems is, when did, for example, let's say you had R.J. Reynolds producing one cigarette and Philip Morris producing another cigarette, and which one caused the cancer? There were just so many problems, and the tobacco company had the money to make the state file each and every one of these cases. So with all of those problems, I just did not see any possibility of a lawsuit. And then I guess a few months later, I was looking at the Florida Medicaid recovery statute and just brainstorming it, and I realized that we could change a few things in that statute to cover all of the issues that I felt would have been there. So anyhow, that was the origination of the what ended up being the lawsuit that ended up being the settlement that ended up being nationally as one professor said, it's the most significant piece of healthcare legislation ever passed in this country.
Is that hands down your most significant case when you look back at your legal career so far?
Yes, it was the most significant thing that I ever did in the practice of law. I mean, when you realize that today, as we sit here some 20 years later, that it is estimated that there are 100,000 American lives this year and each year thereafter that are being saved because of the statute which resulted in the settlement, which resulted in tobacco not only raising the price of the cigarettes, but also having to do advertising and things of that nature. So they figured it was about a 20% drop in the use of tobacco by young people coming on board. And from 500,000 people that were dying each year, 20% savings would have been 100,000 lives, which happens to be more lives, American lives, that we save each year because of this statute than were lost in Vietnam and Korea combined.
You are a former smoker. Ironically, you have had brain and lung cancer. I know you recently recorded a 30-second public service announcement against smoking to warn people, if they're not smokers, not to start. How important was that for you to record that public service announcement?
Well, interestingly, the tobacco, at least according to the doctors, my lung cancer, which is stage 4, which is not good, had nothing to do with smoking. They can determine the type of cancer that is related to smoking, and this was not that kind. However, I realized that as far as the general public is concerned, that when I was on a TV camera saying, I've got stage 4 lung cancer, and you kids ought not start smoking, I realized the impact would have been greater than me saying that even though I smoked, the smoking didn't cause the cancer.
You started from very humble beginnings here practicing law in Pensacola back in the early 60s. This firm has grown into a powerhouse representing clients nationwide, 175 employees, this beautiful radio and television production studio from which we are recording this podcast. But you have not forgotten your roots.
I think that's a fair statement. I never saw myself differently than what I was originally. It never got to me that I was anything special because of some awfully lucky situations. Just for the tobacco situation, that wasn't anything that I really originated. It fell into my lap. Big case that I guess started me as far as the public is concerned, as far as other lawyers are concerned. I mean, you have to realize that case fell in my lap. It didn't. That was the Thorshov versus the L&N Railroad case. So I've never felt that I was this rocket scientist that developed something.
Well, and as a matter of fact, in the past interviews, you have always pointed out that you were not the brightest student. You didn't necessarily do very well on your test scores, but you made up for it with hard work and perseverance. Are those the two enduring values that have brought you the success that you enjoy today?
Yes. I never had the natural ability. Like, my SAT scores were extremely low. I think I was third from the bottom of 360 students that started at the University of Florida College of Law. And I made up for it by extreme preparation. And that was a result of when I entered law school, they really scared me half to death with, here I was competing with all these brilliant law students, and I didn't have the natural ability to compete, so I had to work. And I worked every waking hour. I didn't go to any football games during that time or any parties, or it was just work, and total preparation. And even today, in the practice of law, I can't do what these really great lawyers do, and that is come in and wing it. I have to be totally prepared, and that's the way I was in law school, and that's the way it has been in the practice of law.
Well, tell us, what made you want to be a lawyer?
I was in undergraduate school at the University of Florida. I had never really given a lot of thought to what I was going to do. I figured I would be a businessman. My father was a businessman, and so I figured I'd do something along that lines, never thinking of going to law school. Well, my older brother David had started the practice of law, and I'd been at the university for 4 years, and I really had a good time. So I thought, well, this could give me 3 more years of having this great time. So that's how I ended up deciding to go to law school.
What were the most important lessons in your life growing up, or the lessons that you learned that prepared you for the law or that have guided you during your career?
Well, the most important thing was watching my father. My father he worked 7 days a week, both at the business, and he handled the concessions at the dog track. He handled the concessions at the beach. So I grew up in, I guess you'd call it, that old-fashioned family of the father worked and the mother stayed home to feed the family and clean and take care of things.
Did you have a mentor early in your law career?
My brother David, who I looked up to, and it's amazing. When I graduated law school, I had never made a speech before in my life. All the way through high school, college, I was scared to death of speaking in front of a group of people. I guess initially I was going to be a businessman. And so when I went to law school, I had figured, because I was good with math and I was good with money, that I'd be a tax lawyer. And so I graduated law school, and I had a full year before I could enter NYU tax law school. And so I was here in Pensacola, and the law firm was Levin and Askew. It was my brother David and Reuben Askew, who later went on to become probably Florida's greatest governor. So when I got out of law school, and I was going to spend a year, didn't really know what I was going to do because I darn sure wasn't going to be a trial lawyer. And things happened that I tried to do divorce cases, but the first real divorce case I tried to handle, the woman told me that her husband said he was going to kill her lawyer. And so that ended my divorce career. And so I was really sitting around trying to figure something to do that wasn't going to end up with me having to stand in front of a jury. And this lady came in with a fire claim. Her home had burned down out on what's now Scenic Highway. So I didn't have anything else to do, so I started negotiating with Allstate Insurance Company. They had offered her $15,000, and she wanted something like $17,000. And so I tried negotiating with them, and they weren't going to budge. So I learned how to file a lawsuit, figuring if I filed a lawsuit, they'd come around and at least pay us some more. Well, I filed a lawsuit, and then the baddest lawyer, the best lawyer in Pensacola, Bert Lane, Beggs and Lane, he called me on the phone and said, I tell you what, he said, I'll pay you $15,500 to settle this case. Well, I was scared to death. This was Bert Lane. So I called my client in. I begged her to take the $15,500, and she wouldn't. And I told her she could get it without me taking any fee or anything. She wouldn't take it. As things would happen, I'm stuck. I filed a lawsuit, and so Bert Lane answered and asked for a jury trial. And I didn't know what in the world to do. And as I had done in law school, I started preparing, and I started preparing. And over the next couple of months, getting ready for a federal court case on against Allstate, I did the same thing I did in law school. I prepared in such a way that there was not going to be any surprise. Now, I was probably going to get beat by this great lawyer. So anyhow, we go to court. Can remember that the bailiff and the court reporter and everybody was saying, have you lost your mind? You're going up against Bert Lane. And I mean, I was shaking. It was, but anyhow, I did go to court. I had prepared to the point where I had done also in law school. And that is, there was going to be no surprises. And the jury came back with a total loss, but I think was like $45,000. And then the judge awarded me a $5,000 attorney's fee, which was more money than I was going to make for the whole year as a divorce lawyer and a criminal lawyer. And so then I got to figuring that, well, maybe I could do this. And there was a lot more money in it than it would be for whatever else I could do. So that's how I ended up being a trial lawyer. And then the next few cases were little personal injury cases where they would offer $600 and I wanted $900. And so over a few hundred dollars, I would go to trial. And the defense lawyers, they would pick up the file the day of trial, and I would have worked 3 or 4 weeks getting ready for this few hundred dollar differences. And I was winning. And I started to get the attention of the rest of the legal community, and especially the judges. I mean, I was prepared. I was prepared for the legal issues. And for the really the first time in my life, I was getting known for ability rather than the way I had gone through high school and undergraduate of being, you know, a player, a joker, or things like that. And it felt good. And so that's how my career started. And oh, I went for the longest time without losing a case, just because I totally prepared for every hearing. I totally prepared for trials, even though the time I spent was nowhere near worth the money that it would mean.
So your perseverance, your hard work, obviously the keys to your success then.
Yes. Okay. And it has continued for, what is it, almost 60 years now. To this day, when I try a case, I have totally prepared. I don't think I can ever recall being surprised in a courtroom.
How do you handle disappointment?
It's a good question. I think I can overcome it. I try to make the best out of a disappointment. I see good, and I see a benefit that will come from this. I guess the best example is I'm diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, and I just found out that normally from diagnosis till the end is 8 to 9 months. Well, it's now been 19 months, and I felt like I'm going to overcome this. although I know logically that doesn't make sense. But it never has gotten me down.
How has your involvement with the Florida Justice Association impacted your career?
I met several outstanding lawyers that I would not have otherwise met. I did, you know, as a young lawyer, I attended all of the seminars. I read all of the books and pamphlets that they came out with. And it helped me from a standpoint of different arguments to use, different theories that I probably would not have otherwise done. And so that helped, the relationships. And I do enjoy the accolades. And having been a member of the FJA and having received, you know, the Perry Nichols Award and different things like that, I enjoyed it.
And my goodness, you've had the accolades, the National Trial Lawyers Hall of Fame, Best Lawyers in America, America's Elite Trial Attorneys, U.S. News and World Report Best Law Firms. You're a member of the Inner Circle of Advocates, which is a very exclusive group limited to 100 lawyers. You've been described by some as flamboyant and brazen, as others as an inspiring innovator who's brought great societal benefits. Which is it? Or is it both?
I think it's both. I will sort of weave these stories into great publicity for me. But at the same time, I came up with a lot of novel approaches that have benefited the legal profession. And I think I also have been maybe not a direct mentor, but I think that in many instances, people who did not have that great natural ability see in me an opportunity for them to do well.
What's your view on the future of the legal profession? What concerns do you have?
I think that doing the type of work that I do, which is single event, personal injury, or wrongful death cases, slowly but surely is going away. First, you got a lot more lawyers going after the same business. When I first started, nobody wanted to do this type of work. And you are seeing the laws that are being used against what I do for a living in the plaintiff's position. And you've got a lot more safety devices. So everything is going against the trial lawyer who did and still does what I do. Although mass torts is the thing that I know our firm is being attracted to because that's where the money is. So all in all, unless you've got some legacy or some guarantee, I would not suggest that you go to law school, especially if you're going to come out to be a trial lawyer. And I just think that pretty much the day of the trial lawyer, you know, the Clarence Darrow or this kind of thing, are pretty much over. Other than you might be a white-collar criminal lawyer. There might be some corporate work for a litigator. But the chance of you coming out of law school getting with those kind of firms are very, very slim.
We've talked about the law. Let's talk ethics. Do the ends sometimes justify the means?
I can tell you this, that I do not know. And like I say, it's over 55 years of the practice of law. I do not ever believe that I did anything unethical. I mean, I played by the rules. I can't say the same thing for a lot of the plaintiff's lawyers and almost all of the defense lawyers. They're in such a situation that in order to keep their business, they've got to do everything they can. I think that in most instances, from a defense, they could do away with the case, either by settlement or trial or whatever it is, without the tremendous expense that goes into motions and things of that nature. It's not unethical what they do, but they have to do it to survive. I think that the defense bar has a lot more problems with ethics than the plaintiff's bar.
Fred, how would you like to be remembered?
Well, I would like to be remembered, it's from a standpoint of law, as a great trial lawyer who did not have the natural ability, but had enough sense to work hard enough, prepare, that made him that successful. Now, unfortunately, doing that preparation of 7 days a week and all waking hours, and that's been pretty much my career up until starting with law school and up until when I was diagnosed, that was pretty much it. The regrets concern family. I was not a good husband and I was not a good father. Fortunately, I mean, my wife's been gone for almost 7 years, but the four children have turned out to be very successful and very good kids that I had very little to do with. You know, you're not hugging and kissing on the kids or not going to the ball games. I think I thought that there were 13 graduations between high school, college, and post-graduate college work that I ended up attending one. And that's not a good, legacy. We only went on two family vacations. One of them ended up in a disaster. I really did some soul searching, and I'm not so sure whether I would have given up all of the accolades, all of the awards. You know, everywhere you go, Mr. Levin, you're a superstar. And to have been a superstar, certainly with the kids, they are, I think, relatively happy. They're financially in great shape. And let me say this about most of the family problems, husband, wife, children, and everything else, most of them boil down to a financial situation. That makes up for a lot of problems. So with the kids, if they had it to have their daddy there more and less benefits financially for them, I'm not so sure that they would have did that. Now, my wife is a different story. I'm not so sure she would have agreed with what I think the kids would agree to.
And as your own dad did to you, you to your children showed them the value of hard work.
Yes. Yeah.
And you have very successful children. One's a circuit judge. The other works for the Kennedy Center, Justice Center.
And the other two are do Make a Dream, whatever the charity work they both do.
Fred Levin, you are a titan of trial. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.